This podcast is for educational purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect the official policy or position of the Ted Stevens Center, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
General Bussier, welcome to Arctic Connections. It's great to have you here. I would love to have you in studio, but we'll take you on video. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
So just to get us started here quickly, I just want to give our audience a quick overview, a little bit on Global Strike Command itself. So Global Strike Command provides combat-ready forces to conduct strategic nuclear deterrence and global strike operations in support of combatant commanders. Nuclear deterrence is a strategy that uses nuclear weapons to prevent other countries from attacking. The goal here is to maintain peace by threatening a retaliatory nuclear strike if an attack occurs. The Arctic is a key region for nuclear deterrence and nuclear deterrence strategy because of its relative proximity to other strategic locations, Washington, Moscow, and a majority of the Northern Hemisphere. Of course, Russia's nuclear capacity is in the Arctic on the Kola Peninsula, and it's not just the U.S. that we're talking about. In Russia, we're talking about, just to be clear, globally, the Arctic is a strategic nuclear theater, notably as a staging or launching area. So to get started, General, I kind of want to talk about the state of play when it comes to deterrence. And at the core of Global Strike Command is deterrence. And I think it would be interesting to hear your assessment on our, that is to say the United States' ability to deter competitors, and notably in the Arctic itself. So maybe you could enter into that a little bit.
So Matt, I guess I would offer to you the underpinning of strategic deterrence, and within that, nuclear deterrence is the nuclear triad. You know, and if you go back to the old saying of Strategic Air Command, it's peace through strength. And General Haidt, when he was the commander of STRATCOM, brought back that kind of bumper sticker for U.S. Strategic Command now. But, the way we preserve peace is by strength, and there's nothing stronger that sends a stronger message for strategic, you know, stability and defense of our nation and that of our allies and partners other than the nuclear triad. So, and it transcends generations, right? So like right now, as we speak on this podcast, we have airmen, soldiers, sailors, Marines, and Guardians standing the watch for the nuclear enterprise, whether it's in surveillance, early warning, or patrolling in the submarines in the Pacific or the Atlantic, or sitting alert in our ICBM fields in Air Force Global Strike Command. So every day of every week for decades, our force is maintaining that kind of balance. And for the ICBM force, which is, you know, my force that's on alert 24/7, the bomber leg is not on alert day to day. Since the end of the Cold War, for 50, going on 55 years, but for 54 and a half years, the Minuteman III weapon system has been standing alert for our nation. We've had ICBMs on alert since October 27th, 1962. Hmm. And that is a balancing force to provide stability and deterrence across the fabric of the world. If we tie that into what we're seeing today with whether it's in the Pacific theater, the European theater, or on the peninsula with North Korea or potential actors in the Middle East, the importance, relevance, and prominence of the nuclear deterrence force is just as important today as it was in the 1950s. I'd offer to you, it might be more important today than it was in the 1950s. And the nexus with the Arctic, from a historical perspective or from a current day perspective, you know as well as many that live and work in the Alaskan area that there's a long and storied history of both the Army and the Air Forces being part of the Alaskan area of operations, providing different capabilities and capacities. Mm-hmm. whether that be air bases, naval access points, or radar, or communications. That area not only is a geographic kind of center point for the globe when it comes to potential adversaries, it has a long history of being part of that fabric. To our ability to provide forces in a agile way, Alaska's always been important. And I don't think we're going to see that reduce in the years ahead.
So to that end, you know, in the last decade and certainly even more recently, we've seen strategic platforms such as the B-52 and the B-52 and the B-2 land up here at J-Bear, you know, in other various exercises across the Arctic, I mean, certainly across the world, but in the Arctic as well. You mentioned how long we've been doing this as a nation, how important it is, and maybe it's more important than ever now. You got men and women on watch conducting this mission. How do we know, though, if we're doing enough, notably in comparison to our strategic competitors? You know, we also read a little bit about the advancements that our competitors are making in this space a little bit. How do we know that we're doing enough, in what do these exercises message strategically that would be important for not just our competitors to know, but also for the American people to know as well?
So the basic theory behind strategic deterrence and nuclear deterrence is to prevent a existential attack on the United States or our closest allies and partners that we have formal or informal defense treaties with. You know, if the historians will tell you, since the advent of atomic weapons and now nuclear weapons in World War II and then beyond, and the stabilizing effect it has on the international arena, we have not had nation-state conflict since we developed these capabilities. The whole concept is to prevent attack on the United States that is existential by another nation state with either conventional or nuclear weapons, and to prevent attack on our allies and partners that we have an obligation to defend with our U.S. capabilities. So if you step back from that and go, has that happened in the last 50 years? Yes. There are some people that think that strategic deterrence and nuclear deterrence is supposed to be a warm blanket to prevent all attack. That's not the purpose, mm-hmm. and that's not realistic. But the litmus test of success or failure is that we have not had an existential attack on the United States of America. To answer your question of whether you were doing enough, there are multitude of communities that routinely look at the threats that we see on the fabric of the globe, and then they look at our capability and capacity to deter those threats, and if deterrence fails, to rapidly and aggressively defeat any potential actor that has ill will toward the United States. Mm. So as we look at our current force posture, as we look at our current recapitalization efforts, every senior leadership in the National Capital Region and in Congress routinely looks at whether or not we have the capabilities and capacities to deter bad actors mm. from attacking the United States. And the most recent example of that is last year, about a year ago, either in January or February, I forget exactly the month it came out, but there was a bipartisan strategic posture report that came out from a commission that Congress required. And that report, which is unclassified, folks can Google it and get a copy of the report. There is a secret, or I'm sorry, a classified annex that about different things, but the essence, the preponderance of the report is unclassified and publicly available. Mm-hmm. And that talks about how is the department, how is the government, how is the federal agencies, not just the Department of Defense, postured, you know, to deter attack, to deter nefarious activity on the United States and our national security interests. And then do we have the capability and capacities required to, if required, you know, defeat any potential adversary that believes that today's the day you want to mess with the U.S., which I wouldn't recommend, by the way.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that's something we can flag for some of our audience on the strategic posture report. I want to get a little bit into the modernization and the recapitalization that you had mentioned, but before I get there, I and at the risk of getting a little bit overly scholarly here, but where is the balance between effective deterrence and militarization, perhaps? I mean, if not specifically you, but if a nation or a command allocates more resources in order to help ensure or support the deterrence mission, at the same time, could that risk over-militarizing something, and then onward you go into a security dilemma? Again, I don't want to be too overly scholarly on this, but when we look at the Arctic, we do read a little bit, is the Arctic being overly militarized, or is it just being properly militarized in order to get the mission done?
Yeah, so I'll answer that in two different ways, Matt. The first one is, you know, specific to the nuclear deterrence forces. So I think you and your listeners will be aware that our force posture, our force makeup, and what we hold at risk is dictated by the president. So we don't decide what we need to be able to hold at risk, mm-hmm. that we hold at risk what the nation directs us to hold at risk. Mm-hmm. And the process by which we determine our current force posture, next week, when the new administration takes control of the government, we will be on our 12th straight administration, political party agnostic, that has studied and directed our nation to have a triad, mm-hmm. an air leg, a land leg, and a sea leg, and the associated command and control apparatus to execute and control those forces if directed. So it's not a happenstance process. It's a very deliberate process that has the oversight of Congress, and it's a direct direction from the administration in power at the time. And by law, each administration has to go through that process to evaluate whether or not we have the force posture to do that. As it relates to the Arctic, I would say that even just in the last few years, you've seen the plus up of higher end military capabilities to kind of posture forces in an area of responsibility that is geographically positioned to be able to move around the planet at a time and place required or as directed. Everybody in Alaska knows what Billy Mitchell said about that region back in the 30s. And it is a geographic strategic location. And our nation and our Department of Defense has put the forces there required. Now, to the greater Arctic discussion, that's not a decision or a discussion that is only U.S. Obviously, as you know, more than most people with the Ted Stevens Center, but the Arctic nations will have a say in what happens in the Arctic. I'm not sure that the Council will be able to necessarily control every nation's activities in the Arctic. Mm-hmm. And each individual nation that has Arctic equities and interests will have to make a determination of whether their government's capabilities and capacities are sufficient enough to secure and protect their interests in the Arctic. And it's not unique to the Arctic, right? But that's kind of the next generational area on the planet that people are starting to get interested in because of the decrease in the multi-year sea ice up there. And so there's more access, and there's a lot of capabilities in both the water and below the water that has interest from nations. And so when there's economic interest, when there's fish protein interest, when there's global transportation interest, that will provide an opportunity and a risk. And the opportunity across all nations is to be able to use and have access to those areas. The risk is that some nation is going to try to be the bully on the block, and we have to make sure that as both a U.S. nation, we understand what our policy would be, and then from a Arctic Council willing, coalition of the willing, what our nations together would want to do to make sure we provide security in that region. I think that's a natural progression. I think you have seen that in the last decade, and I don't think the next few decades are going to provide less opportunities or challenges in that region. It's just that we don't necessarily have enough, a mature understanding of what the realm of the possible is there yet.
Yeah.
But to say there's interest in the Arctic is an understatement. Would you agree?
I would certainly agree with that, and that's one of the roles of our center here is to try to educate people and bring the relevant issues to the to people everywhere to have a better repository of information in order to digest this. And I'm certain that we're going to learn more in the days and the weeks and the months and years ahead on what transpires in the region and the like. I do want to take a step back, though, to a couple of things that you just said. And you mentioned the triad, the nuclear triad. You talked a little bit about modernization. And one of your lines of effort, that is to say Global Strike Command, or frankly the U.S. Department of Defense or our nation, is this modernization. And when we talk about modernization for Global Strike Command, I think of specifically the nuclear triad, as you laid out. And I believe it was maybe published on the webpage, your webpage, and it says something like this. Over the next decade, Global Strike Command says there will be new stealth bombers, new helicopters patrolling missile fields, new ICBMs in a new NC-3 architecture. NC-3, for those not familiar, is Nuclear Command Control in Communication, the systems that allows the president to exercise authority over nuclear weapons. There's a lot here. There's a lot in the modernization effort of all of that. I kind of glossed over the triad, which is a lot in itself, and then NC-3. You're overseeing this process now. I think it'd be helpful if you provided an update on what's happening what we've learned so far and sort of where we're headed. And then maybe as a follow-up, we can talk a little bit how this relates to the Arctic, General.
And so we are in the midst of the really the second generational recapitalization of the nuclear triad for our nation. We in Global Strike Command and the Department of the Air Force have the privilege of being stewards of 2/3 of the triad and roughly about 70% of the nuclear command and control communication elements. So we're responsible for the land leg and the air leg, as well as various different aspects of NC-3, as you've articulated. So after the advent of atomic weapons and nuclear weapons at World War II and after World War II and the development of this policy to maintain a triad, the first recapitalization was during the 80s, during the Reagan years, as it's been labeled. This is the second major recapitalization. So essentially it's generational. Every 40 years that our nation has decided to do that. Now, I think history may judge us poorly when it comes to doing it all at the same time, but that's what our nation decided. You know, it might in hindsight be better to do one leg every 10 years or every 15 years versus everything at the same time, but that's where we are. Mm-hmm. So we are recapitalizing the air leg. We're going to replace the B-1 and the B-2 with the B-21 Raider. So it's a new exquisite, low absorbable stealth bomber. We are recapitalizing the land leg with the Minuteman III to the Sentinel weapon system. We are recapitalizing our UH-1 November Vietnam era helicopter with the MH-139 Grey Wolf. Which is a helicopter we use for defense of our missile fields as well as support and defense of our convoys. We're in the process of recapitalizing, we call it the National Airborne Operations Center. It's a 747-200. It's being upgraded to a 747-8i model of the wide-body jumbo jet. And that provides our nation the ability to stay connected with the entire chain of command in a stressed environment or day-to-day to maintain connectivity between the President of the United States all the way down to the fielded forces. We're in the process of recapitalizing the associated weapons or weapon systems associated with those platforms, so whether it's the Sentinel or the bomber leg. And we're in the process of recapitalizing the facilities that support those weapon systems at the various different installations in Air Force Global Strike Command. It is a massive undertaking. Each, just doing one of those would be a pretty large bill for time, energy, manpower, and the ability to do that. The unique aspect that a lot of people don't understand is as we transition from legacy to new, we have an obligation to maintain full operational capability for the nation. So we transition from Minuteman III to Sentinel, we have a minimum requirement that we have to maintain for the nation as we do that. As we transition from, like I say, is analog to digital across the fabric of the command. The nexus to the Arctic or the nexus to that region on the globe, you know, is that we, whether it's the land leg or the NC-3 equipment or the bombers, the fabric of our responsibilities is the globe, right? So we won't talk about how and when we do stuff, but we don't limit our activities to just the continental United States. Obviously, we have the ability from a bomber's perspective to go globally. That's usually manifested with our bomber task force construct. That's the label we use. And we get tasked by the Department of Defense to move bombers around globally. And that's why you've seen B-52s and V-2s in the Alaskan area. Not only it's a great location on the globe to position aircraft, but it's a great location on the globe for us to exercise because of the sheer scale of Alaskan's Joint Operation Area.
Yeah, certainly some great resources up here for assets like that to be able to train. Staying on sort of this nexus with the Arctic, as you know, not only from your current role, but certainly from your previous role as a commander up here on J-Bear with the 11th Air Force and Alaska Command, in the Arctic, command and control is challenging based on some of the communication infrastructure or lack thereof that has existed and to some degree still exists. If we look at the DoD Arctic strategy, developing better communications infrastructure is certainly embedded within there. If you talk about the importance of NC-3 in being able to effectively employ, if necessary, the nuclear triad, you know, I think somebody could maybe come to a reasonable conclusion that it might be more challenging to do in an Arctic when it's more difficult to communicate. Is that really the case? Or how are we to kind of square
that? Yeah, so our command and control architecture is layered, and it's not unique to us. I would say it's across the Department of Defense. You know, our command and control architecture is layered, right? So there's no one single point of failure, whether it's space, aerial, terrestrial layers, and the interaction of those. The department has progressed in the last few years, and if not in the last decade, with propagating capabilities across the department, so that we have the ability to see to command and control our systems in and around the Arctic region. It's a unique area. It's a vast area, and you don't have to look too far on the Alaskan region to realize that you need to have the ability to communicate based on the sheer size and the austere environments. But if you look at, you know, the history of the Department of Defense's presence in Alaska for the last 50 plus years, and you look at both in the past and in the present and then potentially in the future, the viability of using that region for our nation and for our allies and partners to be able to provide both deterrence forces as well as capability to exercise and train. I used to say when I was up there, there is no greater area that you can do joint training in than in the different either land, sea, or air space that Alaska and the Alaskan Joint Operations Area provides. So I don't anticipate the importance or prominence of that region is going to decrease in the next decade or so. I think the technology And the access to that technology is only going to get easier and quicker as we move through the next decade or so.
So I'm glad you mentioned technology. I want to dive into that just a little bit. And this might be a little bit out of your remit right now and within the authority of your command. But when I think of technology, or at least emerging technology, a lot of people, and me included, tend to trend towards autonomous systems. And just to kind of stay with the headlines, I believe that just this morning we read a little bit about a Ukrainian strike on Russia using drones. Of course, that theater is not the only theater that we've seen the deployment of drones. Of course, they've been front and center in the Middle East and the conflict there. But also domestically, you know, in the headlines, we saw the drones flying in around New Jersey, which of course got a lot of headlines. And then even down in L.A. now, we're the fires are burning, and one of the tankers there that was trying to fight the fires runs into it. So it's in all the context. You know, it's lethal drones. It's drones that are doing things that we don't know. It's drones that are getting in the way of emergency response. And so there's different opinions on autonomous systems. And I'm just talking about one. And if we talk about the Arctic a little bit, and a way in which I've thought, and you know, others have advocated that autonomous systems can be effective is more on sensors in maintaining domain awareness. And I try to sometimes reorient the autonomous systems conversation, not away from drones, but adding autonomous systems in order to developing better domain awareness so we can make better decisions, obtain more information to make those decisions that ultimately could lead to more strategic stability. So I kind of took a long way back to kind of deterrence here, ensuring effective deterrence. Again, this might be a little bit outside of your remit right now, but the emerging technology that we're seeing and our ability to enhance our domain awareness in the Arctic specifically, how does that serve your role now, or perhaps in other commands that you've done in the past, notably your role is when you're the commander up here?
So I guess I would approach that topic with a different couple angles. So, if you look at the UASs or the unattended aerial vehicles that aren't doesn't actually have a human being on it. You know, there's different classes, right? So we categorize everything. So there's small UASs all the way up to the larger UASs. And if you look across the fabric of that, so there's a technology spectrum between size and capability of those systems that transcend the different companies, different nations, different purposes, right? So there's a spectrum of capabilities that transcend that category of systems. And then if you look at what we would want them to do, what they're being used for, there are, to your point, very useful applications of those capabilities, especially in the Arctic, because of the size of the region, the unforgiving environment of that region, and the capability, whether it's for monitoring of the environment, looking for search and rescue for hikers, campers, hunters, maritime vessels that are in distress. There's capability and capacity with those systems to be able to be benefit to society and nations. And then if you look at the nuanced threat of those capabilities, either from a small perspective where, the one you highlighted where he was more than likely a hobbyist out there trying to see if, what was going on with the wildfires, or potentially someone looking to try to get situational awareness on the condition of their neighborhood or house, and it ended up hitting a firefighting aircraft. That same kind of threat can be applied to our airport structure, or other aerial capabilities that would be at threat, whether it's a small or a big or a medium type system. And then, of course, there's the other side of the use spectrum where it's no kidding being used as a deliberate either surveillance or threatening capability from either illegal organizations or potential adversaries. So there's a whole spectrum of capabilities and the spectrum of purposes. What I think is important, whether it's in the Arctic or in the lower 48, and the challenge that we're seeing is the kind of the tension point between national policies as it relates to the different federal entities, where, for example, the FAA considers those capabilities and capacities in the category of an airplane, even though they may not be the size or scale of an airplane. So the different federal entities that have policies or rules or laws that apply to the application or use of those, and then the ability for either federal law enforcement agencies or the Department of Defense, depending if we're talking about law enforcement or national defense, to affect those capabilities. So there's a technology requirement that we as a nation, the technology's there. We have the capability and the technology and the different industry partners to be able to detect, deter, or defeat those capabilities. It's just a matter of making sure that we field them at the right place, at the right time, with the right authorities within our federal government's architecture to be able to make sure that we can prevent bad things from happening. Again, that transcends the nation. It's not unique to the Arctic, but when I was up there a few years ago, there were, I think it was the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, had a great partnership with drones to be able to test because of the range availability. And the applications are really just limited by someone's imagination.
And I wonder if that context is still the same today with autonomous systems being able to be deployed in a lethal manner, or at least a sort of a nefarious manner at greater and greater ranges with greater and greater effectiveness, such as we've seen in other theaters. And I'm wondering if that changes our strategic thinking from the Arctic being an area that's difficult to operate and maybe favors the defense a little bit to a theater in which maybe it's easier to be on offense and perhaps because it's cheaper to fly something that doesn't require, manning, if you will.
Yeah, I think we're going to see that, and that's not necessarily unique in our time, right? So as technology is developed and either nations or humans develop applications of those technologies, we see that application being used for the good and the positive, and then we see those applications being applied to potentially nefarious or ill will. We have to, and it's not, the technology topic is agnostic. We develop capabilities to defend or deter those other capabilities, and it's a natural evolution. I think we're going to see that with these systems, whether it's ground, maritime, or aerial autonomous systems. We will see them being developed for good and for bad. And then we'll see nations like the U.S. and other allies and partners develop capabilities to defend or defeat those capabilities. It's the natural evolution of technology, I think the real part is to make sure we have the smart people thinking through those and making sure we're getting on the front end of that power curve with the industry and with the technologists and academic institutions and think tanks and labs. I'm confident that the technology is available and we have smart people. We just need to point them in the right direction and let them loose.
Yeah, we can certainly get into a whole conversation about some of that technology, and maybe we'll save that for another time. I want to kind of reorient our azimuth just slightly a little bit to kind of pull in a different theater a little bit, and that's the Indo-Pacific theater. As you know, General, from your time up here, sitting here in Alaska, we're at the intersection of the Arctic and the Pacific. This is quite literally where they converge, which might explain a little bit why this is also at least near the area or the theater in which we saw China and Russia jointly campaigning off the coast of Alaska. The national security strategy outlines Russia as the acute threat. China is the pacing threat. They're both active in the Indo-Pacific theater, and you could argue both active in the Arctic theater. And staying on the topic of deterrence, I'm wondering how might deterrence efforts in the Pacific impact deterrence efforts or just DoD initiatives in the Arctic? What are some of the synergies here? What can we pull out of this?
Yeah, I guess I would agree with your premise and your statement about the nexus of Alaska between, you know, the Arctic, potential interaction between Russia, China, and then the other potential nefarious activity in the Indo-Pacific region. It's kind of that nexus, and we're seeing the activity that that kind of reinforces that belief in the last few months, if not few years. And that's, you know, the whole concept of deterrence, whether it's conventional or nuclear, is that you have capability, you have capacity, and you have clear will, right? So deterrence is in the minds of potential adversaries. It's not necessarily in our minds, right? Mm-hmm. We know what our capabilities are. We know what our capacity is. We need to very clearly transmit our national will and our clear messaging to the leaders of any potential adversary that we have the capability, the capacity, and the will to deter, if necessary, defeat nefarious activity as it relates to our national security needs and those of our allies and partners that we have obligations to protect. And that really transcends weapons or weapon systems, right? The capability of a nation to deter bad actors is kind of a conglomerate of all the national capabilities. And, you know, we love to throw out the term whole of government, but it really truly is a nation's requirement to defend a nation. And a lot of people just think toward the United States Department of Defense as the sole responsible agent for defense. Obviously, that's in our name, but the federal government departments all have a play in it, right? So we think military when we're talking about deterrence, but that deterrence is a fabric of the entire government capability and capacity to convince any potential adversary that, A, we're serious about what we don't want you to do, and we have the capability and capacity to negate your benefits of any potential action. And again, if you step back from that broad categorization and framework and look at the region of the Arctic, look at the joint operations area in Alaska, and the nexus between the European theater, the Indo-Pacific theater, and the Arctic area of operations, it truly is an important part of our nation. And I think the investment in Alaska from a Department of Defense perspective, Department of the Air Force perspective, and the investment in access and placement is an indication of why we continue to keep our eye on that region of the world.
So one of the initiatives we've stood up here at the Center General is what we're calling the Arctic-Pacific Security Dialogue, just less a line of effort to discuss exactly what you're framing here, defining sort of what this nexus is, but then drawing out its relations to issues, topics, functions, what have you, themes even, you know, deterrence, how deterrence in the Pacific, sort of as I asked you, can relate to deterrence in the Arctic, or quite literally, as you said, kind of deterrence everywhere in that sense.
I wouldn't categorize deterrence as a region or a capability, right? We tend to, you know, the big dog on the block is nuclear deterrence, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not the only deterrence that the U.S. and our allies and partners have to prevent bad actions. I mean, the ultimate guarantee of U.S. national security is the nuclear triad. The ultimate guarantee of preventing existential attacks on the United States is the ability to hold at risk anything any potential adversary holds of value at a time and place of our choosing. So that kind of framework and wrapper is really the bubble of protection for the United States that has survived decades. And then there's different layers of that deterrence bubble depending on the region or what we're talking about from a capability in the Department of Defense. But it's not just one or the other, right? So the ability to deter transcends a region or a capability within the Department of Defense. And it's really the strength of it, right? Mm-hmm. But our ability to deter is in the mind of the potential adversary, not necessarily in our own minds.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that it's a regional. Sometimes we do get focused on capabilities in a particular region or our a mission in a particular region. And along the line of this effort, the Arctic Pacific Security Dialogue, we do or are going to speak a little bit about investments in the Arctic region, not so much as them being Arctic investments, but more so just investments in the Arctic region that benefit right. missions elsewhere. And I think there's a difference, even though it's a bit nuanced. It's not an Arctic investment simply for investment. And when I say investment, I mean to support DoD initiatives right. or what have you, or national security. It's an investment that happens to be in that region that can enhance efforts in the Indo-Pacific, or even you said, following the arc over into the UCOM theater of operations.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Well, maybe more on that later. As we approach the end of our time here, I do want to ask a little bit. You followed the growth and really the birth of the Ted Stevens Center itself. Here we're about 3 years old now, and are taking on more and more each and every day, working with partners and allies, and of course the services here in the United States to tackle different things. I'm curious, from your perspective, having seen the center evolve from its birth through infancy and on, and then looking into the future on the topics and issues that are relevant, how can the center best position itself to support, say, yourself, other commanders, other senior leaders, in order to support our national security priorities?
So My thoughts, you know, several years ago when we started this journey is, and I was a little bit, I was a little bit biased, right? Because I truly do believe, and I did believe at the time, and I do believe now, that the Arctic and Alaska is kind of the hub, right? And if you branch out from that hub to our previous conversation about the Indo-Pacific region, the European theater, or the Arctic, access, placement, and location are important. And so not having a securities center or a national security center similar to what we had in Europe or have in Europe and in Hawaii or in the lower 48, we were missing a major piece of the ability to educate and build understanding and advocacy. So I view the Ted Stevens Center as kind of the hub to be able to branch in and connect with the other security centers to be able to build a deeper understanding. Because again, we tend to do things in silos, right? It's not unique to the securities centers. It's in the services, it's in within the services. We tend to be silos of excellence, and we become experts on certain capability capacity regions. We can't do that anymore. Right? We need to be able to, the globe is the fabric of our environment. The threats transcend both domains and regions. And I'd offer to you, the benefit of the Ted Stevens Center is the ability to tie in and pull those different regions together to have a common understanding, a common voice, and be able to look at the world and the globe from a realistic perspective. I would offer to you the Arctic and Alaska looks at the globe from a regional, or not from a regional perspective, from a global perspective. And so that's something I learned in Alaska, is that you don't look at it from a region. You know, the way you look at the globe is different in Alaska than the other parts of our nation. So I think that's the benefit of having this now stood up. And over the next year or next decade, pulling the other centers together and building a deeper understanding of what the Arctic is, what the Arctic provides, and providing maybe that leadership at your level in the Ted Stevens Center to be able to tie in those other areas. Because, you know, by with and through, right? By with and through. And we see that every day.
Well, to that end, you might be pleased to know then that shortly forthcoming and actually ongoing, we do a partnered event with the George C. Marshall Center, and thus a little bit with European Command, called the High North Security Dialogue, and then as I mentioned, the Arctic Pacific Security Dialogue, and Enterprise will enter in with the Asia Pacific Center there, as you referenced in Hawaii. We're also bringing some of our Arctic allies, the attaché stationed in D.C., up to Nome, Alaska, for an Arctic Defense Attaché Field Seminar to get them some exposure on what could be called, you know, NATO's Western Flank. And in I think an evolution of that, perhaps, and I'd be curious for your opinion on this, is, you know, there's some integration there, implied a little bit of integrating the other geographic commands into the conversation via the regional centers. But an evolution, perhaps, would be bringing in some of the functional commands as well, such as Transcom, Stratcom, and on, you know, even Cybercom, for that matter, on down the line, to bring in the issues as well, which is being done, but it's maybe less obvious in the sense because it's not regional.
Right. No, I think that's spot on. I see the Ted Stevens Center as kind of being that connective tissue that pulls it all together. Because, again, you can't have a discussion on national security, you can't have a discussion on deterrence, you can't have a discussion on operations in the European theater or in the Indo-Pacific theater, in my opinion, without having a deep appreciation and understanding of the Arctic. Because if we do that, we do it at our own peril. And that's the opportunity and benefit of the Ted Stevens Center, is to be able to kind of be the shining light to bring that all together over the next coming decade.
Well, we'll look to have you back on the program here sometime soon, or welcome you back to the center, or have
hopefully I can do it in person next time.
Yeah, that'd be great. Or maybe we could do it in person at some other location further afield if we happen to be out in the same place at the same time. But General, it's been great to have you. Thanks for being an advocate and a supporter and a contributor to the center, and we're standing by to support any of your initiatives whenever and wherever those might be.
No, I appreciate it. It's great seeing you.
Very good. That wraps it up here. Thanks.
All right.